is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, April 1st, 2020. I'm Buster Olney in my home studio in New York. Taylor Schwenk is producing from his home studio in Connecticut. Today we'll be talking with Jim Cott, a player, coach, and broadcaster for more than 60 years. And man, is he loaded with stories about everyone from Ted Williams to Sandy Koufax to Madison Bumgarner. Paul Hembekidis will join us, and we'll also hear from Tim Kirkchin. Before we get to all that, some news and notes. Major League Baseball is extending support for minor league players, financial support that will continue through May 31st or until the beginning of the minor league season, whichever comes first. Players will continue to get $400 per week in salary and then also medical benefits. Major League Baseball veterans will be getting $4,775 daily for 60 days during this virus, stopping that from the Associated Press. So players like Garrett Cole, Mike Trout will receive a total of $286,000. Dr. James Andrews has temporarily suspended Tommy John surgery in keeping with his state's decision to end all non-urgent, non-emergency procedures. And of course, Dr. James Andrews, famous for doing a lot of Tommy John surgeries during the course of his career. The city of Toronto has banned public events at least until June 30th. Now, there was a follow-up to that. The city of Toronto clarified that and said that doesn't necessarily extend to professional sports, but that's going to be a situation to watch as we move forward. Before we get to Jim, consider checking out the latest episode of the Adam Schefter podcast. This week, he talks with the medical director for the NFL Players Association, Tom Mayer, who shares insight into how the NFL is coping with the COVID-19 virus. Plus, former GM Michael Lombardi talks about how front offices are getting ready for the draft without having a lot of information. And Arizona Cardinals defensive end Chandler Jones hops on to talk about the 150,000 meals he donated to food banks in Arizona and New York. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Jim Cott played 25 years in the majors. He pitched 4,530 and a third innings. That's 25th all time, 898 games. And of course, you've seen his analysis on TV for years, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure. It's kind of good to talk some baseball with what's going on in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Before we get to that, these days, as we wait to see what happens, how are you spending your days?
Well, we're very fortunate down here in Martin County, Florida. I mean, compared to the Northeast and some of the cities, we're paying attention and being careful, but we're able to, we're able to play golf down here, outdoors, walk, fishing, things like that. So we're much more fortunate than most.
Yeah, so we just, we'll hope for the best here as we move forward, and certainly for you, stay safe. I was going back through your career record. I thought a fun conversation might be, we see at the beginning of every game where the analysts will give scouting reports on the pitchers. And I thought, given the fact that you faced so many Hall of Famers, so many all-time greats in your lifetime, you pitched to them, to get your perspective as a pitcher in working to these guys. And I'll start with this name, Ted Williams, who you faced at the beginning of your career. In his career against you, 2-for-3 with 2 walks. What do you remember about facing him?
Well, when I got called, actually, I had had surgery that year. When I got called up, they were just throwing me into a game just to kind of see if I could get some innings in. I hadn't pitched for a while, and lo and behold, there's Teddy Ballgame standing in the box. I remember turning around and kind of mouthing to our second baseman, John Shivey, who I'd played in the minor leagues with, and I said, "Shive, I'm facing Ted Williams. Do you believe this?" And the first two at bats, I got him 0-2, and the first 0-2 count, I threw a sidearm curve. He took that off the 379 sign and left center. And then the next time, 0-2, a fastball outside, and he almost took Shivey's glove off with it. Then in 1960, I faced him early in the year. That was his last year, and I did get him out. He pinch hit against me, I think, first start in 1960. Of course, later I got a chance to speak at the dedication of the Ted Williams Tunnel and got to know Ted pretty well. So, I didn't do that well against him, but I counted it a real honor to have faced, one of the greatest hitters of all time.
Now, you don't strike me as being someone, even as a young pitcher who was afraid. What was that like to be standing on the mound? It sounded like it was a case of more awe than fear.
Yeah, I think it was, Buster, because nowadays the young pitchers, the players that come up, I think are so much more comfortable when they see the stars of today because of cable television. You know, there's so much more exposure. In those days, games weren't on TV. It was a radio game. So I remember coming out to the park that morning. Security was nothing, so I found a little opening at Fenway Park, and I went and sat in the stands by the third base dugout, and every day Ted Williams would play Pepper with Tom Yawkey, the owner, and Johnny Orlando, the clubhouse guy. So I watched him play Pepper, and I just looked at him, you know, as if to say, wow, that is really Ted Williams in person. And then they bring in two or three batting practice pitchers. He'd get in the cage and hit for 20 minutes. And so, yes, it was much more being awestruck than it would be today, because I've never seen him in person or on television. That was the first time I ever saw Ted Williams, other than on the baseball card I had.
Jim, what was it like to get to know him?
Oh, I went up to play golf in Central Florida at a place called Black Diamond, and his picture was on a billboard. He had his hitting museum up there. I walked in the pro shop. I said, "Ted Williams ever play golf?" He said he's on the 17th fairway right now with Eddie Fainer, the famous softball pitcher, the king in his court. So I said, "Do you mind if I take a cart? I'd like to go out and see him." So the friend that was with me, Doc Gallagher, we drove out, and I waited till he walked off the green. And I said, "Mr. Williams," he said, "Don't give me that, Mr. Williams. I know who you are. You try to throw that big curveball." You know, he broke right into a conversation about pitching and hitting. And I think that's what was so enjoyable. No matter whether you were a rookie or a veteran, if you wanted to talk baseball, Ted made you feel very comfortable. And that's what I appreciated about my brief relationship with him.
Did you find that he had he mentioned your curveball. Did he have very specific memories of his plate appearances against you? Because as you know, it's remarkable whether it's a Peyton Manning or a Tony Gwynn or Ted Williams. A lot of these guys possess that ability.
Yeah, I know he mentioned the curveball, and I don't know. I only threw it to him a few times. I only faced it three times, but yeah, he did remember that.
All right. I want to ask you, first off, who would you guess had more home runs against you than any other hitter in the regular season?
I would say Al Kaline.
You got it. 10 home runs, yeah. A Hall of Famer. What do you remember about pitching to him?
Well, when people ask me who's the toughest hitter you ever faced, I always say Al Kaline. Brooks Robinson had as good an average, but he didn't do the damage. But Kaline he swung at every pitch like he knew it was coming. And later, of course, I got to know him when he broadcast games for the Tigers, and we've been to the Gold Glove dinner together. He's just a wonderful individual. The one thing that my 25th win in 1966 was a 1-0 win. Tony Oliva hit a home run in the bottom of the ninth, and Al Kaline struck out three times in that game. And it was a Saturday afternoon game, and I saw him the next day. We didn't track that much with players, but I knew him well enough to say hi, and he'd say hi. And so he was behind the cage, and I said, "Were you trying yesterday?" I said, you, "There's no way you could strike out three times against me." He said, "Well, it was kind of a bright day in the glare in center field, and I didn't pick up the ball well, but I just thought that was unbelievable that I was able to strike him out three times in one game." Because my roommate Jim Merritt and I, Jim was a left-hand pitcher, and sometimes we'd pitch back-to-back. And we would lay on our beds in the room and say, "Well, next 2 days, what do you think, Kaline? What's he going to go, 7-for-10, 6-for-9? You know, we wondered how many times we'd get him out, because he just he never had a bad swing. And he was one of those hitters, like Frank Robinson, if you buzzed him up and in and pushed him off the plate, he only got better. His eyes got bigger and the ball looked bigger, so you couldn't intimidate him at all. And he just wore me out.
Who was the hitter that you struck out the most? Give me a guess on that. It's another Hall of Famer.
I would say Reggie Jackson.
That's exactly right. 27. How did you, what was it like pitching to him?
Well, what happened when Richie got called up, the end of, was it 67? I think he might have got called up the end of 67, or it was in that time frame. And of course, we didn't have advanced scouting reports. And looked at the lineup card. It was Kansas City with the A's, and it said Jackson L, which meant left-hand hitter. And I said, anybody know anything about this Jackson kid? And they said, well, they say he's got good power to the opposite field. So I said to Earl Batty, and I think Jerry Zimmerman was one of our catchers then too, I said, well, most of the time left-hand hitters, I like to pitch them outside, you know, because my ball moved back across the outside corner. Most lefties try to pull the ball. So my first time against Reggie, I got him 1-2, and I had said, I got to run the ball up and in on him and, you know, get it in on his hands. And it got up a little too far and in a little too far, and it hit the knob of his bat. He went sprawling on the ground, and then he got up and kind of looked at me, and I threw a strong probe and froze him for strike three. And when I got in, I said, every game that I face him once or twice, we got to run the ball up in there on him. And Reggie, he admitted it, and we laughed about it later, but he said the same. He said, you know, I knew once or twice you were coming up in there, but I didn't know when. So, you know, the advantage I had is I was an experienced pitcher, and at the time he was just a young hitter. So I was able to take advantage of him. He hit a couple of bombs off me, but for the most part, I had success against him.
All right, what about pitching to Mickey Mantle? What was that like?
Well, Mickey was an all-or-nothing guy, and my broadcast partner, Bob Costas, knows, you know, the one at-bat that he had that was such a heartbreaker. But Mickey hit 7 home runs off me. They were all solo. And Mickey was a high ball hitter, right-handed, low ball hitter, left-handed. So me being a left-hand pitcher, he's obviously a high ball hitter. And my most memorable at-bat was 67, the great pennant race we had. I had a 1-0 lead with 2 out in the 9th. Russ Nixon was the catcher, and I never liked catchers coming to the mound, but he slowly walked out to the mound. The count went to 3-1, and he came out to the mound, and he said, what do you think? And I didn't, I said, well, I don't want to walk Mickey Mantle, because I said, you look over in the on-deck circle, and there's Elston Howell. And Elston hit me well, and that, you remember the old stadium, that 344 sign out in right center field was a pretty good target. I said, I'm going after him. And I did, and he went after me, and he hit it over the 457 sign out in the left center to tie the game at 1. And that game got rained out in the 10th inning, suspended at a 1-1 tie. I went back in there a month later, and I pitched a pickup game. I gave up a run in the first inning. I was hooked up with lefty Steve Barber, and the Yankees beat me 1-0. So I pitched 2 complete games. I gave up 2 runs. I got a loss and a tie. And that was the most memorable home run that that Mickey hit off me.
What was he like? I'm sure through the – I mean, you're such a gregarious person. I've always heard great stories about Mickey, how he was with other players. What did you ever get a chance to talk with him?
Oh, very much. You know, he did later in our alumni outings, he used to – he would – be on one tee, he'd hit the shot for every group that came through. And then actually in the winter of 66, 67, because I'd had a decent year in 66, so I got invited to some of these writers' banquets, and I would, alphabetically, I would be seated next to Mickey, K and M. And he had, I want to say, it wasn't his 500th home run, but there was something historic that Mickey got invited to a lot of the banquets. So I did get to know him personally. He was just as you'd expect. You know, he was just a humble country kid. Just the old saying where he said, you know, if I knew I was going to live longer, I'd have taken better care of myself. He just, I think he admitted that later, that he didn't like the publicity. There was a lot made of he and both, you know, not being friendly when they had that home run race. And that was just the opposite, because in 61, they lived together. They were friends. But, yeah, Mickey was such a pleasant guy to talk to off the, you know, outside of the field, because he treated you just like any other person. He didn't act like he was above anybody.
Carl Yastrzemski, Hall of Famer. And it was interesting looking at those numbers, Jim, that he had just two home runs in 151 plate appearances against you. How'd you pitch to him?
Well, Yaz and I faced each other in AAA ball. And believe it or not, we would swing the outfield way around to left and play him like a singles hitter hitting the opposite way, because his early years, he didn't have a lot of power. And then that 67 Triple Crown year where he just turned everything around and had one of the great individual years, and September, one of the great months, I think, that any hitter's ever had, particularly in a pennant race. But Yaz did some working out that winter. I think some trainer he ran into, you may know the story, where the trainer said, "Man, you're in the worst shape I've ever seen for guys who's a professional athlete." So he got Yaz, I think, lifting some weights and getting stronger. And all of a sudden, those pitches inside that we would hit him on the handle, all of a sudden he's turning and wrapping them around the pesky pole out there in right center. So he didn't hit a lot of home runs, but he got his hits. I'm sure, I think the three guys I faced more than any three hitters are all Hall of Famers: Louis Aparicio, Brooks Robinson, and Yaz. And I think Yaz's average was just a touch under 300 against me. So he got his hits.
Now, you mentioned the 67 season. You know, one of my early years as a baseball fan, 1981, Fernando Valenzuela. I was a huge Dodger fan. And so I'd, you know, every morning I'd wake up to look at the box score early that year. He'd be like, "Oh my God, he did it again." And as you were talking about Yaz, I get the feeling that probably 67 was like that for you, being in a pennant race, sort of following what he and the Red Sox were doing down the stretch.
Yeah, there wasn't any Sports Center or any highlight shows. The way you followed the game was you looked at that box score the next day and you say, "Oh yeah, I did it again, 2 for 4. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And you mentioned Fernando. I was fortunate to be with the Cardinals when Fernando came on the scene, and that was equally as exciting, just to see every day he pitched and how impressive he was.
What are your memories about Hank Aaron and Willie Mays?
Well, I faced them in the All-Star game in 66. We didn't have interleague play. And so, again, I just, you know, remember them from their trading card. And, of course, Henry was my favorite position player, because growing up in southwestern Michigan, on a Sunday afternoon, baseball, of course, in the late 40s, early to mid 50s was a radio game. And on Sunday afternoon, I could listen to 8 games because everybody played a doubleheader. So I had Harry Heilman with the Tigers, Jack Brickhouse with the Cubs, Bob Elson with the White Sox, and then Earl Gillespie and Blaine Walsh did the Braves. And I'd pick up WTMJ. And I loved the Braves, and I loved what Henry did, you know, in those mid 50s. And then when he was with the Brewers, I actually got to face him the same lineup when Robin Yount was a 19-year-old rookie. Hank Aaron was in the same lineup, so I got to face him then. I think he did take me deep one time in Milwaukee, and then the only time I faced Willie, I believe he got a base hit off me in the 66 All-Star game.
And, of course, you famously pitched against Sandy Koufax in the World Series. What do you remember about facing him, just from a perspective as a batter?
Oh, well, I don't know if I got a foul ball or not. I might have barely kicked one as a batter. But from a pitcher's standpoint, I remember, you know, game two, it was kind of a funny story about he didn't pitch game one because of the Jewish holiday. Yom Kippur, Drysdale pitched game one, and we knocked out Big D, I think, middle of the game, fourth inning or something. We roughed him up pretty good, and Walter Alston came out to take the ball. And Drysdale looked at him and said, "I bet you wish I was Jewish, don't you?" But Sandy pitched game two. So we're out in the bullpen in Minneapolis at the old Met. And it's a cold, gray day, you know. And he said, you guys play in this weather?" And I thought, man, that's the only chance we have. You know, I'd never seen him in person. No TV, because when they were on TV on Saturday, we were playing. That's the only game of the week. So, we get warmed up and start the game, and we each go through the batting order the first time. But I remember sitting down next to Johnny Sain, our pitching coach, and I said, "John, if I give up the run, this game's over. I said, there's nobody can touch this guy. Well, I think Tony got a hit. Somebody else booked a single, and we got a lead. And Bob Allison made a fantastic catch to bail me out of trouble in the fifth inning. And then Drysdale pinch hit for him in the seventh, and we went on to win the game 5-1. Then he came back in game five and shut us out. And then on 2 days rest in game seven, shut us out on three hits, and only he couldn't throw a curveball after the fourth inning. So he was just, for me, the greatest pitcher of my baseball era. I know Gibby and Mon Marichal are not far behind, but for a guy like Sandy to pitch for a team that didn't give him a lot of run support, he just was the gold standard.
Now, Jim, I worked with Phil Collier, who was a baseball writer with the San Diego Union. And Phil Collier was the one who in the summer of 66 was he was friends with Sandy and he would golf with him. And Sandy told him during the summer, hey, off the record, I'm going to retire after this year's over. And Phil, you know, being a good reporter with integrity, never mentioned it. And then he got he told me the story about how he got, when he came in, one day early in the off season, his wife said, Sandy called and said, write it. And that's how, you know, the news broke. Phil Collier broke the news that Sandy Koufax was retiring. What do you remember about that? And were you shocked or were you very aware of all the discomfort that he pitched through especially 65 and 66?
Yeah, well, looking back on it, I wasn't shocked because I'll tell you what would happen in the 65 series. Incidentally, as a piece of trivia, I believe that was the last 7-game World Series where every win was a complete game win. But what Wow. They did before the game, they took photographs of the two starting pitchers. So I have some nice pictures on my wall at my home in Vermont, shaking hands with Sandy and we were standing behind the cage getting our picture taken. I had tears running down my eyes. I said to him, what do you have on? Well, he had two tubes. There's a hot ointment called Capsulin. It's that if you get it in your eyes, you'll suffer. But it's that really hot ointment that pitchers used to rub on their arm to kind of kill the pain. Well, he had two tubes of that Capsulin slathered all over his arm and the back of his left shoulder. So I knew even in 65, he was pitching with a lot of pain. Obviously, we didn't have the Tommy John surgery at that time, so we didn't have any way to get that elbow repaired. So, you know, looking back on the way he was pitching in 65, it didn't surprise me that I think Dr. Job may have influenced him, too, and just say that your elbow you're going to have a lifetime full of pain if you keep using it like that. So it wasn't that big of a shock that he retired.
You remember, just out of curiosity, do you remember the moment that you heard that he was retiring?
I don't. I was at that 66 World Series. I was hosting a group from Minnesota, from Toro Lawnmowers, and I watched that 66 World Series. And, you know, none of them pitched very bad. I think most of those games were 1-0 and 2-1. But I don't remember exactly where I was. But, you know, knowing that he had pitched those four dominant years, I mean, when you look at the years he had, 63 through 66, I don't know if anybody had 4 years in the modern era, had 4 years like that when you combine, you know, innings, wins, strikeouts. He struck out 300 more batters than he walked in, I want to say, 65. I believe he struck out like 382 batters and walked 80 or something like that.
Yep.
So, and you know, in those days, we didn't have all the pitches that the guys do today. It was fastball, curveball. He threw an awful lot of curveballs. That's one thing that, you know, as hard as Sandy threw, he had a dominant, sharp, 12-6 curveball and good control of it. So, you know, pitching every 4 days and pitching 300 and some innings, why it just took its toll.
All right. I want to ask you about the current generation of pitchers, and from a pitching perspective, what separates the guys I'm going to mention to you from their peers? Gerrit Cole, we start with him. He just signed that record setting deal with the Yankees, $324 million.
Well, I think what sets apart Cole, Verlander, Scherzer, you know, Johnny Sain told me early in my career as a coach. You get hitters out four ways. You get them out with stuff, you know, good live fastball, curveball. You get them out with a change of speeds. You get them out with control or with motion, with a deceptive motion. Now, if you have dominant stuff and control, like Koufax did, like Gibson, like Marichal, like Seaver, that sets you apart from the rest of the pack. And I think that's what Garrett Cole and then Verlander and Scherzer, no matter what their off, you know, their secondary pitches are, in addition to throwing hard, they have great command of their fastball. And that's usually the case with any pitchers, whether you're a hard thrower or not. If you don't have command of your fastball, you're not going to be as successful as the ones that do.
What's jumped out at you during the course of Kershaw's career?
Well, the early part of the career, you know, he had such a great breaking ball. I think he still does, but and he's got kind of a funky motion, and I think that's probably what caused eventually his back issues. You know, when you take a pitcher out of high school or college, and all of a sudden you're in professional baseball, you're logging a lot more innings than you did as an amateur. And I think with Clayton's motion, those back issues began to show up, and that's what kind of caused, if you can call it, a decline. You know, because he was so dominant those early days. But I think it was his, again, command of the fastball, but he had almost a Koufax-like curveball.
Jacob deGrom of the Mets.
Oh, I love Jacob deGrom because he's a here it is, hit it if you can. You know, he has an effortless motion. That's what made Mariano Rivera so effective. In addition to that, that cutter, is devastating as the cutter was, Mole looked like he was playing catch with the catcher. You know, there was no effort at all in his motion. The ball just came out of his hand so easily. And I'm sure that added to the fact to the hitter that it probably got on him a little quicker than they anticipated. You take a pitcher like Scherzer, Max, no pun intended, is a max effort guy on every pitch. You can't call that what you'd call an easy fastball, easy life on the fastball, and that's what DeGrom has. And again, I think the fact that he has excellent control.
And
he's got such a repeatable motion. He never looks like he's out of rhythm or out of sync in any way.
And last one for you. Give me the name of a pitcher that you just love to watch compete. Because I actually sort of strategically finished up with DeGrom as I got ready for this interview, because I just got the sense that you probably loved watching him compete.
Yeah, I do. I don't, you know, we used to say years ago when Nolan Ryan was in his heyday throwing all those no hitters, and we'd say, you know, people pay money to come out and watch Nolan pitch and see a no hitter. I said, I pay money to watch Mike Cuellar pitch. Remember Mike Cuellar?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Crazy Horse, they called him. He couldn't black your eye from 60 feet, but he throw that hook up there, that screwball, and change speeds. So I love to watch guys like that, like Maddox and even Jamie Moyer. I love to watch pitchers like that operate. Don't see that many of them anymore because kids, if they don't throw 90-plus, they don't get a chance to advance. But, yeah, DeGrom is one guy I like them all, really. I like to see Scherzer operate, DeGrom, Cole, Verlander, Clayton Kershaw. I'll tell you, maybe my favorite, he's gone down just a little bit in the last couple of years, but I like Madison Bumgarner, because when you see the ball come out of his glove, you'll see some photographs. He's got this long wingspan. So there's not a lot of if you see like a Tanaka, some of the Asian pitchers, they have a lot of elbow bending and a lot of angles before they actually release the ball. Mad Bum, the ball just comes out of his glove, it points back towards second base, and here it comes. And I've always liked him, especially during the heyday when the Giants were winning.
Now, have you gotten to know him at all, Jim? Have you been able to have some conversations with him?
I never have. I've heard a lot about him through my friend Mike Kuko. I put him on the list. You know, when you look at him, you think he might be a linebacker. This guy's a beast. He's really big and strong, but I've never had a chance to talk personally with him.
Well, I'll finish with my favorite story about Baumgartner. I once asked him, I had to double check something because I was going to talk about him on Sunday Night Baseball. I said, hey, Madison, is it true that when you got married, you gave your wife a cow? And he looked at me and he goes, that's not true. When we got married, I gave my wife a bull. And then when he paused, he said, and now it's a steer. And that's Madison Baumgartner to me.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. The other story, if you got time about him, you may have heard this one, is the Giants bus broke down. And the busie was on the cell phone calling in for some help. And Baumgartner got out of the bus in the back. It was a, you know, a diesel with the engine in the back, lifted it up, tinkered inside, and he came around, said the busie were ready to go. So fixed it on his own.
Wow. You know, and there are 1,000 Baumgartner stories. Jake Peavy told me one about how late in the game, and this was actually one of the games that we did, but they were losing to the Dodgers 2-1, and Baumgartner was due to hit in the eighth inning, in the top of the eighth. And, of course, Bochy planned on pinch hitting for him. So he goes down to tell Madison, you know, he's batting for him, and right away Baumgartner's like, you know, I got this. This is my game. I'm going to go here. I think it was against Kershaw that night. Or actually, it was against Greinke, and he kept on lobbing the bat, and Bochy kept on saying, I know, I know. And, you know, Madison would make his case, and Bochy would go, I know, I know. And then Baumgartner looks at him and said, you ain't talking to me like you know. And and so Bochy decided to let him hit. He struck out. But Peavy told me, this was in 2014, he said that was a moment down the stretch that galvanized the players. Like, they knew how Baumgartner was like, I got this, which he certainly did during that postseason run.
He sure did.
All right, Jim. Well, hey, I appreciate the time and the stories and distracting us a little bit from the realities of the world these days.
Yeah, that's for sure, Buster. I hope we see each other soon at the ballpark.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
Hembo, of course, is Paul Mbachiti. He's a researcher at ESPN who is a honcho on the show Get Up. He tells us he's the head honcho. Hembo, you got a chance to listen to Jim Cott's interview. What'd you think?
I thought that Jim Cott was extraordinary, and he's not someone who is really celebrated, and he's someone who's for some reason is sort of lost in history, I would say, but he's had really an extraordinary life in baseball as a player and then as a broadcaster. And when I went back and looked into his log, as you obviously did before you did his interview, one thing that I just thought was just so astonishing that I think sums up his career maybe better than anything else. Buster, as a rookie, you said he faced Ted Williams, which is an extraordinary thing. Ted Williams, of course, was born in the year 1918. In Jim Cott's final season, he faced Daryl Strawberry. Those two guys were born 44 years apart. And to think that Jim Cott's career spanned those two guys as competitors is a pretty extraordinary thing. But I have to say that the most stunning thing that he said, or the thing that made me perk up the most, was when he said, when people ask me who's the toughest hitter you ever faced, I always say Al Kaline. He swung at every pitch like he knew it was coming. Jim Cott faced 38 different Hall of Fame hitters, Buster, a total of 1,374 times. You know, I'm writing a book. Al Kaline is going to be a small part of that book. And I can tell you for sure that Jim Cott quote is going to make its way in there, because that is an extraordinary thing to say about someone in Al Kaline, who I believe has also been sort of misremembered or underremembered, I should say, historically.
Yeah, and you're right. I feel like Jim Cott should be celebrated more. You know what, 284 career wins?
50, yeah, and more than 50 wins above replacement, a whole flurry of gold gloves. Like, he's someone who I think someday, like, you never know how these things go in the Hall of Fame, but there will be conversations in the future about that on some of these various committees.
Oh, no doubt. And to be clear, 283 wins. I'm looking at his record now, 16 gold gloves. And here's the thing, is that he's had this incredible life in baseball. And I really do hope at some point that a veterans committee takes another serious look at him. Because I was prepping for that interview, I'm like, why isn't he not in the hall? Why is he not like that person? Could not, there's nobody who would be more natural sitting on the back porch at the Otisaga among Hall of Famers than Jim Cott, who should be a Hall of Famer.
All right. It's a good way of putting it, man.
All right. So you wanted to react to what he said about Sandy Koufax.
Yeah, Sandy Koufax's baseball reference page is a sight to behold. And Jim Cott was obviously oohing and aahing about the way that Koufax's career ended. I just want to put a couple numbers to it that I think are most impressive. He mentioned that in 1 year he had 300 more strikeouts than walks. It was 311 to be exact in 1965. Buster, that is the largest gap of its kind in the modern era. In fact, Randy Johnson is the only other pitcher to be plus 300 in any season. He did that in 2001. Further, Koufax's ERA in his last five seasons, Buster, was 1.95. It's the lowest five-season span of any pitcher in the live ball era, and obviously due to the extraordinary nature of the way that his career ended, he's the only player elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame by the writers before the age of 40.
Yeah, I feel like that Sandy Koufax and Pedro Martinez are like two special cases when we talk about all-time great pitchers, because their periods of dominance, while maybe not as long as Bob Gibson or, in the end, probably going to wind up being, a Madison Bumgarner or Nolan Ryan. Their period of absolute dominance was unbelievable. Give me a stat on some of the current pitchers that he talked about. First, Gerrit Cole.
Gerrit Cole, Buster, last season induced 120 swinging strikeouts on pitches 98 miles per hour or faster. No other pitcher had more than 40 of those.
That's unbelievable.
I mean,
Clayton Kershaw.
He was all over that. Last season, Buster, 150 of Kershaw's 189 strikeouts came via the breaking ball. That's his slider plus his curveball. That's 79% of his total. It was the highest percentage in a season for him and the second highest rate in baseball among all qualifiers. He continues to reinvent himself.
Didn't surprise me that Jim Cott likes watching Jacob DeGrom pitch. What do you got on him?
DeGrom owns an ERA plus of 148, Buster, through six seasons. Among all pitchers to debut in the live ball era, that ranks first. That ranks number one. Number two is Kershaw, and number three is Lefty Grove. And DeGrom has pitched in front of a group that ranks 25th in defensive efficiency since he debuted in 2014. This guy's run prevention is historic. He is absolutely on a Hall of Fame trajectory.
Wow. Max Scherzer.
Scherzer's fastball is dominant, Buster, even when he misses location. In 2019, Scherzer threw 150 fastballs, middle-middle, theoretical meatballs. Hitters went 10 for 44 in at-bats ending on those pitches and swung and missed with 22% frequency. There's no such thing as mistake pitch if that pitch is Max Scherzer's fastball.
Madison Bumgarner.
165 different pitchers have thrown at least 20 innings in the World Series. Bumgarner's ERA and batting average allowed, Buster, both rank first among that group. Bumgarner has allowed only one earned run in the Fall Classic, and it came on a Salvador Perez solo homer with the Giants up 7-0 in Game 1 of the 2014 series. When it's mattered, he hasn't given up a thing.
Somebody needs to write a book on him. There are more stories about Madison Bumgarner than just about that story about the team bus. I had never heard that one. That was awesome.
It was a tremendous story. It was such a Madison Bumgarner. Like his stories, I think, are going to be very much like Satchel Paige or Yogi Berra, like very much legendary. We don't revere athletes the same way and tell stories the same way that we used to. But Madison Bumgarner is a throwback, and he is certainly someone for whom we should.
Every day on ESPN.com, Tim Kirkchin is providing a baseball fix. Today's episode is about Hall of Famer Phil Niekro. Give a listen.
On this date in 1939, knuckleball pitcher Phil Niekro was born, and here's how he won his 300th game. The day before, the Blue Jays had clinched the division title, and Phil was pitching the next day for the Yankees, and as Phil said, their whole team was hungover. So, he and his brother Joe had decided the night before that Joe would pitch in relief of Phil in order to have a part of his 300th win. But with two outs in the ninth inning, Phil has a shutout going, and Joe, not the pitching coach, comes to the mound and says, if you get one more out, you'll be the oldest man ever to throw a shutout. So Phil said, well, forget the plan. Get the hell off of the mound. So the only question now was, do they intentionally walk Jeff Burrows, who had been a teammate of Phil's in Atlanta, or pitch to him? So Jeff Burrows looks at Phil and says, pitch to me. Phil throws a knuckleball. The last pitch of the game is this far outside. Burrows swings at it, strikes out. Phil has his historic shutout and his 300th win, And he told me it was the only knuckleball I threw the entire game.
Tim is going to join us on the podcast on Thursday and tell us how he does that. Like the other day, he got a lot of response because he was palming a basketball, Taylor.
Are you serious? I didn't see that.
Yeah, he did. He did one on Michael Jordan, and I knew as soon as he saw it, I was like, oh, he's going to show off his ability to palm a basketball, which is really important for Tim to tell everybody he's got big hands.
So this is something he brags about regularly.
It's a regular topic on the broadcast that he does. Yes, that is, his hands are big enough for him to palm a basketball.
And he'll never let you forget it.
Nope.
That's hilarious.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. Jake Reagan writes in _ Jake Reagan on Twitter. What's most likely of the following? Mookie never plays a game as a Dodger. Real Muto never plays another game as a Philly, or the Mets non-tender Syndergaard?
That's a fascinating question. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to go with Mookie never plays a game as a Dodger, because if the season is in fact lost and Mookie will become a free agent, never having played for the Dodgers, they could re-sign him. They could bring him back. And I still think that that's the most likely thing to happen, most likely place for him to land. But among those three scenarios, I'd say Mookie never playing for the Dodgers.
I'd agree with you there. Senior Hendricks, at Senior Hendricks. If the entire 2020 season gets canceled, do you think there will be a lot more players playing in the winter leagues?
Absolutely. Because they're, first and foremost, there'll be some players who'll be making a look, make a little bit of cash during the wintertime. And if, in fact, there's baseball in winter ball, if there is winter ball, then I bet you a lot of players will go down there. And, of course, there'll be some players who are just looking to get in baseball shape after having a lot of time off.
Last one for today, Gnome at Gnome 89. He writes in, there's a lot of spitting in baseball, in the dugout, on the field, into gloves. Players lick their fingers and sometimes even lick their bats. Do you see this easing up at all when baseball comes back? I would imagine so.
Yeah, Gnome, I do think so. I think players will be self-conscious, but let me tell you something. There's no more ugly sight than the floor of a dugout after games. With all the seeds and all the spitting and everything that goes on, the tobacco, everything that's thrown at the bottom of a dugout. I do think when players get back, they'll be a little bit more conscious, self-aware about the spitting that they do.
Everyone gets their own dip spit cup with their name on it. I can see it already.
I'm going to have to ask Jameson Tye on that question. You know, we got him on the podcast for tomorrow. I think that's a good question for me to ask.
Sounds good. That does it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please subscribe, rate, and review to this fine podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
That's it for today. My thanks to Jim Cott, to Hembo, to Tim, to Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.